On a single day in February 1991, a U.S. Army squadron, about 1,100 men, nearly wiped out a brigade of elite Iraqi troops more than twice as large. To military history buffs, the Battle of 73 Easting is legendary because it was the largest U.S. Army tank battle since World War II, and it's considered one of the Army's greatest post-war tactical victories. It took place along a north-south grid line of a military map in the Iraqi desert. The unit at the tip of the spear was the 2nd Squadron of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, better known as Cougar Squadron. The man who led Cougar Squadron into battle was then-Major Douglas MacGregor. He received a Bronze Star for valor. He's now written a memoir of that fight. It's called Warrior's Rage, and Douglas MacGregor is in the studio with me. Welcome.
Thank you.
Douglas MacGregor, that day, the 26th of February, 1991, your squadron had destroyed more than 90 tanks and left perhaps as many as 1,500 Iraqi Republican Guardsmen dead. Take us back to that day. Where were we in the first Gulf War? Where were we at that point?
At this point, we're 3.5 days into the ground campaign.
The air campaign had already begun.
The air campaign had been going on for almost 40 days at this point. We go through, we destroy unknown numbers of tanks, at least 35 to 40 in the initial assault. And we run out of targets to shoot.
Eventually, the higher-ups, through the chain of command, order you to halt and then to turn back. And you argue in this book that that was an incredibly consequential turning point in this war, in the 91 Gulf War.
Well, the halt, of course, I had not much influence over continuing the attack. And I said, I see no reason for us to give this ground up. We had fought for this. We'd come through. Why should we fall back? Fortunately, Deputy Regimental Commander Steve Robinette heard the radio conversation and gave us permission to stay where we were. So we ended up staying for several more hours and engaged the enemy. Finally, after midnight, other units who had been 8, 9, 10 hours behind us finally come through. But of course, by the time they moved through, most of the enemy who had previously been there had long since left and gone to Iraq, gone back there.
After the first Gulf War of 1991, there was a victory parade here in Washington, D.C. There's a ticker tape parade in New York City. You call it the lie of 1991, the myth, you write, that the first Gulf War was actually a success. And in your view, if anything, it was a hollow success.
Oh, absolutely. And we lost a man, Sergeant Muller. And the question is, for what are we sacrificing all of these lives? What did he ultimately die for? Now, he believed he was paying part of the price for victory. To him, victory meant the removal of this regime, in his mind and in the minds, I think, of all of us. It wasn't simply running people out of Kuwait who didn't belong in Kuwait. We allowed this force to escape, and we allowed this regime to persist, and we made our return to Iraq inevitable.
A lot of officers, Doug MacGregor, were genuinely concerned about unnecessary U.S. casualties. And many of them had experience in Vietnam, people like General Schwarzkopf, people like General Colin Powell, who was the chief of staff. Can you blame their reluctance? I mean, can you blame them for ordering a halt?
Yes. The general officer corps that you have today and the corps that has emerged over many, many years.
This is post-Vietnam.
Yeah, post-Vietnam. Is a very bureaucratic, highly conservative, risk-averse, cautious, and timid. These are people who absolutely do not want to fight unless they are compelled to do so, and they see only one way to fight, and that is to bring in hundreds of thousands of men and huge numbers of equipment and pulverize everything from the air. If you go back to 1991, this air campaign was designed to defeat Germany in 1943 and 44.
This is the bombing campaign that began in mid-January
right.
of 91.
I mean, this is this biblical air campaign, 40 days and 40 nights of destruction. It was unnecessary. The real enemy was sitting down in Kuwait and in southern Iraq. It was called the Republican Guard Corps. It was the foundation for Saddam Hussein's power. That was your enemy. We needed to dispatch it. We didn't. It escaped. And this war has dragged on as a result. And the worst of all possible outcomes is now being achieved, and that is Iran is now dominant in Iraq, the very thing that everyone in 1991 rightly worried about, and it is the thing that has happened.
Critics of your book and of you, because you have been vocal in your criticism of both the Iraq and the Afghan wars, point to the fact that a lot of people mentioned in this book who make cameo appearances, if you will, David Petraeus, H.R. McMaster, Doug Lute, they were all eventually promoted. They became generals. And that you were not promoted after you achieved the rank of colonel, and that, that this is simply a reflection of your bitterness.
Well, you know, my book, Breaking the Phalanx, was published in January of 1997, and it advocated the radical reorganization and reform of the Army. When that book came out, it was abundantly clear to me, given the response of the retired and active four stars, that I was not going to be promoted any longer. After 1997, the idea of ever being a general was pretty much put out of my mind.
That book was not liked by them because...
Well, I disbanded the large divisions and created large 5,000 to 6,000-man battle groups. I reoriented the force to a different structure.
Something that looks pretty similar to what the Army has done today with combat brigades.
Well, they've done some of it. The things that they've done have not fundamentally altered the basic structure and content of the Army. Now, what we are doing, I think, which is very ill-advised, is that we are converting more and more of the Army to this light infantry constabulary force.
Counterinsurgency.
Yes, on the grounds of counterinsurgency, which, and remember, insurgency simply means you are suppressing rebellions against your presence. And as a result, the kind of force that performed so brilliantly in 1991, that force is vanishing.
I mean, but what should the Army of today learn from that battle? I mean, you're talking about an armored unit, a tank battle. How does that translate in any way to the way the Army should confront the Taliban and al-Qaeda, for example, in Afghanistan?
Armor, firepower, and mobility combined trump everything on the battlefield. It's how you wage war. In Iraq, several times we came very close to losing control of the country. And in each case, we sent in armor. The Canadians in Afghanistan have brought in Leopard 2 tanks from Germany, probably the best tank in the world. And as soon as they introduced Leopard 2s into the equation in Afghanistan, their casualties dropped to virtually zero. My point is that there is no substitute for mobility, armor, and firepower, because the enemy is quite delighted to fight you on his terms. And remember, his terms are rifles, machine guns, and mines, not armor.
Douglas McGregor is a retired Army colonel. His new book is called Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle of 73 Easting. He joined me here in the studio. Doug McGregor, thanks so much.
And thank you very much.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and I'm joined by James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, for a look at this past week's news. Jim, welcome on this miserable, rainy Washington afternoon.
Well, we didn't come to Washington for the weather.
Jim, first to Afghanistan and Pakistan. As we just heard, a lot happening there. The August 20th election still up in the air, a military offensive by the Pakistani army to dislodge militants, and of course the Obama administration still trying to figure out its military strategy in the region.
Potentially the most important development of this past week are the indications that there may need to be a runoff election in Afghanistan, that the incumbent, Mr. Karzai, did not get a majority of the vote. The reason this matters is that so much of the General Petraeus strategy of counterinsurgency that he's developed in Iraq and Afghanistan rests on the idea that with a very large presence across the country, you'll make people's lives better in all sorts of ways and eventually win their hearts and minds, as we used to say. That depends on governmental legitimacy from top to bottom, from the national level to the regional level and the local police. And so problems with legitimacy at the national level make this even harder for the U.S. To deal with.
Jim, turning to matters here in Washington, a victory for Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee this past week. They managed to win the support of Maine Republican Olympia Snowe for their health care bill. But the industry, the health insurance industry, is now pushing back with a study that shows health care costs will actually rise. And Jim, I want to play a clip from President Obama's weekly address from today where he goes after those critics.
Every time we get close to passing reform, the insurance companies produce these phony studies as a prescription and say, take one of these and call us in a decade. Well, not this time.
Jim, the Democrats have avoided a confrontation with the insurance industry so far, even getting the industry on board for a time, but that seems to be changing.
Yes, this week marked a very dramatic shift in the administration's strategy on this issue, and you could even say in general, the Obama approach, you know, in large has been to try to get people under the tent and working together, including with the insurance industry, which Bill and Hillary Clinton attacked head-on 15 years ago. When the insurance companies came out with a study saying that the plan essentially wouldn't work and would raise costs for most consumers, the Obama administration is going at them more directly with the president's address today. It's possible that the result result could be a more liberal, quote-unquote, plan in the long run, with the kind of public option as an alternative to insurance plans if the administration has decided that it just can't work with the insurers at all anymore.
This week, the stock market passed 10,000 for the first time since March. A new round of Wall Street bonuses also announced. But clearly, Jim, that doesn't look good for an administration that promised to be tough on Wall Street excesses.
You know, certainly it's better overall to have a Dow average at 10,000 than 6,000, as it was a couple of months ago. But there are a couple of both real and political problems. I think the real problem is that it's a known fact of economics that the financial recovery precedes the real recovery of jobs across the country, which are expected to be in trouble for quite some time. The political problem is when you have large financial companies giving out the kinds of bonuses that they were doing 2 and 3 years ago, which has started to occur again, it becomes difficult for the president to say this really is a changed regime and the companies we bailed out with such a cost a year ago now are profiteering again.
Finally, Jim, to the story that just keeps giving this bizarre tale of a boy who was thought to be floating in a runaway balloon over Colorado, and it captivated cable television for hours.
We got reports that a six-year-old boy got his way into this, what the parents call a homemade flying saucer.
We should also point out, a great credit to the authorities in Colorado. The FAA was able to essentially identify the position of this this helium balloon.
Well, this type of balloon is certainly no gas balloon I've ever seen.
And again, not knowing how the basket was attached, if it was attached when it launched.
For those of you joining us now, many of you just now getting home and looking at these images, it's certainly a haunting situation as we've been following it now for about 1 hour.
And Jim, on and on it went.
I feel somehow not like a real American because I was in a car during this entire period and didn't see the balloon in real time. But what this episode actually made me think of, to be mildly serious for a second, is there's all these tech world studies now showing that you actually become a little bit stupider when you're subject to constant distraction by pop-up messages or whatever. I think you could make a somewhat serious case about our national intelligence, too, when you have sort of a system, a perpetual distraction machine where any spectacle on cable TV from the O.J. era on blots out anything else. So that's my view.
Well, I watched it. Certainly, it may have affected some of my brain cells. That's our news analyst and Atlantic correspondent, James Fallows. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.
It's been 46 years since a boy named Max first tamed the wild things by staring into their yellow eyes, without blinking once. The wild things are even wilder in the new movie version of Maurice Sendak's classic kids' book, but they still look pretty much the same. Now, back in 1986, Maurice Sendak told Terry Gross on Fresh Air about what inspired his drawings for Where the Wild Things Are. Take a listen.
I didn't want them to be traditional monsters, like griffins and gorillas and such like. I wanted them to be very, very personal. They had to come out of my own particular life. And I remember it took a very long time until that gestation occurred and where they began to appear on drawing paper and they began to be what I liked. And it was only when I had them all that I realized they were all my Jewish relatives. They were all the adults who treated us in such silly fashions when we were kids. And these were the real monsters of my childhood. You know, people come on Sunday and wait to get fed, uncles and aunts, and they all say the same dumb thing. Or you're beating time till food gets put on the table, how big you are and how fat you got, and you look so good we can eat you up. In fact, we knew they would because my mother was the slowest cooker in Brooklyn, so if she didn't hurry up, they would eat us up. So the only entertainment was watching their bloodshot eyes and how bad their teeth were. You know, children are monstrously cruel about physical defects. You know, the hair curling out of the nose and the weird mole on the side of the head. And so you would glue in on that and then you'd talk about it with your brother and sister later. And they became the wild things.
That's author Maurice Sendak on Fresh Air in 1986. Now, other than the look of the wild things, the movie doesn't resemble the book very much. But that doesn't bother our critic Bob Mondello one bit.
Max, played by a wide-eyed cherub named Max Records, makes his first appearance on a total tear, trashing his house, hurling snowballs at some older kids, throwing a fit when they cave in his igloo. For the first 20 minutes, the camera catches him in the act of being a really unruly kid. He even bites his mom when she doesn't give him enough attention, then realizes he's gone too far, and bolts out the door to a place where things are just as wild as he is. Big, furry things, roaring and smashing up their homes in a forest. Fearless, he roars in and smashes too. Maurice Sendak's story doesn't explain Max much, or the wild things either. In book form, it's 30-some-odd pages and 10 sentences. So the filmmakers expand, first giving Max a backstory that makes him a realistically kid-like kid, and then building a fantasy landscape that's just as persuasive. Real-world igloos transformed into giant curved forts, cross-hatched with twigs so they look like Sendak drawings, while snowballs become giant dirt clods.
I have an idea! Come out!
No!
Why not?
Because you're gonna hit us in the head with dirt!
Come out!
No!
Why not?
Because when I said you're gonna hit us in the head with dirt, you didn't say anything! That means you're planning to hit us in the head with dirt!
Man, you really have us figured out.
Though I'm guessing the filmmakers have Max and his buddies figured out, too, they let the audience do the interpretive work. Director Spike Jones and screenwriter Dave Eggers have taken enough liberties with Where the Wild Things Are that they'll no doubt infuriate Sendak literalists, but they've enhanced the tale in ways that aren't just true to its spirit, but actually make it richer, allowing Max to explore not just a forest, but a whole landscape of things that worry him, like when his teacher said in class that the sun would someday use up all its fuel and go out.
Did you know the sun was gonna die?
What?
What are new friends for, if not to discuss stuff like that?
I never heard that. Oh, come on. That can't happen. I mean, you're the king. Look at me. I'm big. How could guys like us worry about a tiny little thing like the sun? Huh?
I won't be the only one who sees James Gandolfini's snaggle-toothed monster as a sort of uncowardly lion. The postmodern Oz he inhabits, actually Australian forests and dunes populated by Jim Henson's Creature Shop, is a world that's beautiful and visionary and a little scary at times, rather than comfortingly dumbed down and jokey like most kids' movies. Jones has created the sort of Oz that existentialist Samuel Beckett might have pictured, if he'd had a really playful childhood, turning Where the Wild Things Are into a work of cinematic art, lovely and smart enough that you don't have to be a child to appreciate it. I'm Bob Mondello.